This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History is now streaming on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Grammarly. Today, people are working to innovate and do more in their workdays, but coming up with fresh ideas and quick responses can be tough. Introducing Grammarly Go, a product offering personalized generative AI communication assistance that will change the way you write. With just a few clicks, Grammarly Go can ideate, compose, and rewrite thoughtfully, accelerating your productivity and unlocking your creativity. Go to grammarly.com/go.
Hey, y'all, thanks so much for listening to the show. Before we start, quick plug for another show, Up First. It's NPR's morning news podcast. Up First is about 12 minutes long, and it's produced and posted at 6 a.m. every weekday morning. The show makes you real smart, real fast, and I listen every day. You can hear Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast. Hey, y'all. Sam Sanders here. It's been a minute. Every Tuesday, we bring you a deep dive conversation. Today, I am talking to novelist Danzy Senna about so many things. We're talking about race. We talk about how, whatever your race, it's something that we all kind of perform. We're talking about how the internet and current politics affect all of this. And we're talking about what it means to have artistic integrity in an era of safe spaces. All these issues come up in Danzy's new novel. It's called New People. It's the story of a light-skinned black woman named Maria. She lives in Brooklyn in the 90s. The character has a really interesting group of friends, a bunch of young black intellectuals trying to figure out their racial identity. And she has a nickname for them all. It is a very hilarious twist on the N-word. You will hear it in the interview. There's also some really serious and scary drama in the book as well that I don't want to spoil, so I won't tell you any more about that. But let me just say, could not put this book down. Also, here's why I think you'll really like this chat. I find usually a lot of times with issues like politics or race or gender, things we seem to be always talking about, it often feels like we are saying the same things over and over again on those topics. Well, this conversation today, it just felt new, even to me. So let's get to it. Here's Danzy Senna. She was in Los Angeles. I was in New Orleans, where I happened to be for a conference of black journalists, purely by coincidence. Danzy's new book is called New People. Enjoy. I spent some time reading up on you in advance of this interview, and I have the smallest bone to pick.
Oh, good.
You said a thing about Los Angeles that wasn't that nice. I used to live there for about 2 years and loved it.
Oh, you did?
Thoroughly. I did.
You loved it?
I was on Mar Vista. I loved it. Yeah.
Oh, good.
What's not to love?
I love it, too. I mean, I think I know what you're referring to.
Well, then you can say what I'm referring to.
You think I'm referring to saying it was boring?
Yeah.
Is that what I said? Well, you know
what
I was
thinking? You said it's so boring. Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking that after I said that, I came here and immediately started having children, and that might actually be the boring part. It's that I came here and, like, left my 20s and my youth behind and started to, like, be a grown-up here. So I don't think of L.A. L.A. is not a boring city, but it's more the quiet. I think it's got that necessary quiet that's very productive for creative thinking. Mm. It's a much nicer way to put it.
That is. Well, because if I recall correctly, paraphrasing you, you said L.A. is so boring that your imagination becomes your life.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a lot of downtime and sort of you're not as overstimulated by humanity as you are in New York. But I think it's a good thing, and I meant it in the best possible way.
I'm just teasing you. All right. One more question about place, and then we'll get to the heavy stuff. You reference in the book one of the characters, two of the characters actually, live in graduate housing near Harvard, I believe, right?
Yeah. The mother, Gloria raises Maria there. Yeah.
In this graduate housing that you compare to a prison. Are you talking about Peabody Terrace?
Yeah, I think I am.
I used to live there.
Oh, my God. It does look kind of like a prison, right? It's really
it
tall.
Does.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
But I mean, this is what I loved about the book so much. Like every other page, I was like, oh, that's my life. That's me.
Oh my God.
Oh, she got me. She got me. Because, like, you know, one of the big themes in the book is how Black people, people who see themselves as Black, how they constantly figure out and define and assert their Blackness. And in the book, Maria's having a tough road of it because of the color of her skin. But when I thought about it more, you know, I am a Black person who you see and you know that I'm Black right away. But I grapple with defining my Blackness, too. Like, in this day and age, and I know that neither you or I can speak for all the Blacks, but, like...
Oh, let's do it.
I feel like a lot... Let's do it.
Let's get in trouble.
I feel like a lot of us struggle every day in how we define, assert, and claim our racial identity.
Yeah. And I think especially at the age that Maria is in her late 20s, and it... For her, it kind of is defining itself on who she chooses to love and kind of partner herself with. It seems to play out with men a lot in terms of her sexuality, because her partner is this guy, Khalil, who is half Black and half Jewish and only came to his understanding of his Black identity through dating her. And so
before her, he was like... playing hacky sack and frisbee with the white guys, right?
Exactly. He was wearing a Bad Brains t-shirt, so he was, and he had the Basquiat hair, but he was only surrounded by kind of alterna white people, as she calls them, and they were at Stanford, and she kind of led him into his Black identity, and she's sort of watching it with a little bit of a cynical smirk because she's been there a lot longer than he has, despite her appearance, and I think there's a bit of a kind of eye rolling in her in
yeah.
general about people and their search for identity.
Which is so interesting because, like, she's the one probably trying to assert her identity as Black more than Khalil is. And, you know, there's this interesting scene when everyone's at this dinner, all the new Blacks, the, you know, the members of the Niggerati. I love that word, by the way.
Yeah.
You say, this group and the pantomime of their newly discovered Blackness. It's catching, the craze. We once were lost, but now we're Black. It's so old school, it's new school. They have taken on their duties as Negroes with aplomb. She's got to give them that. They are born again Black people. They weeble and wobble on their new roller skates and almost fall. But she has to give them an A for effort. And I was like, I know those guys.
Yeah. No, I mean, she's a little nasty as a character. And that's sort of why she was so much fun, is that she's always kind of throwing shade at people. And I think that, you know, she was raised only with her Black mother, who adopted mm-hmm. her and was mm-hmm. disappointed. Her mother was part of a kind of Black feminist awakening in the 70s and wanted to adopt and raise a Black daughter and got a Black daughter, but the daughter was so light-skinned that she appeared to be white, and she kept sort of waiting for her daughter's hair to change texture and her skin to darken up, and it just never happened.
Never did.
But Maria has been raised, you know, watching Roots and subscribing mm-hmm. to Essence magazine and identifying herself as Black, and so I think for her, the more of the dissonance is the way that the world sees her as white and
well, yeah.
how she's read.
And I mean, you got to feel bad for her because some folks think she looks white. Some folks think she looks Latino. Like, she's just like, that would drive me crazy.
Yeah, she's kind of like a Rorschach test for the culture.
Yeah. How much of that struggle with how society sees you have you felt? I mean, you are a Black person that some folks would see and not know what you are or think you're white. Are the anxieties that Maria has in the book also some of your own?
Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm old school in a way because my mother is white and my father is Black, and I was raised only to identify as Black, which is what you did in
exactly.
my generation. Like, it wasn't like there was another box to check. And my parents, being the people they were very pro-Black identity and sort of really pushed that side of us. And all my siblings and I all were raised never thinking of ourselves as anything other than like light-skinned Black people.
Yeah.
So now I've come of age and there's like other generations coming, and that's a very different struggle. For me, passing as white was always a kind of difficult experience because of the amount of racism I was exposed to kind of secondhand.
And secondhand, the way that explain
Where I would walk into spaces that were all white and have to listen to the and sort of be aware of the two faces of whiteness, the face that white people wore when they knew there was a black person in the room, and then the sort of falling away of that mask when they thought they were alone. And I was always privy to that. And that was a huge part of my identity and my kind of coming of age politically was that awareness. But in a funny way, I didn't ever really struggle with, am I black or am I white? Like, that was never on the table. I was just a black person that happened to look white. And and I think that's like another generation almost. And it wasn't like, there's no point was I, did I ever think of myself as a white person in my entire life? And, you know, blackness is such a complex, hugely mixed race. I mean, we are not just one thing. So for me, that was always part of it, was that, you know, within blackness, there's all these different classes and shades and geographies. And a black person walks into a room, and not every black person is going to have the same experience or be read the same way. So I'm really, I think, interested in that diversity within us.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like... There's a scene in the book where Maria, in her quest, I guess, to up the black quotient, she gets a perm to make her hair curlier. her soon-to-be husband compares her to a poodle. But the whole time I was thinking, I was like, you know what? If Maria was in the age of the smartphone and black Twitter, she would have done some Googling and had someone help her figure out the right perm to get. And
she
then I was like, well,
Rachel Dolezal. Could have helped her out. Right.
Could have helped her out. But then I was thinking, you know, there were so many things that Maria had to do in the book that would have just been made easier with the smartphone.
Well, she's stalking someone, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, stalking
is so much easier if she could just
cleaner.
Map them out.
If she could just be on Facebook stalking him, it wouldn't have been as good a novel, right?
That is so true. But, like, would her search for true blackness have been easier in this age in which everyone can figure out how to be woke on Twitter?
Oh, man. I don't know, because my students seem to struggle and perform their identities in the same way that we did.
Really? And these are undergrads?
Yeah. I mean, the ones that I'm referring to, like, there's been... I think it's like a age-old anxiety of a certain age group, you know, where everyone's trying to figure out their identity. Do you think that? I mean, do you see that it's easier now to proclaim your... Is it proclaim your blackness or find your blackness
Like, make sure that you're doing it enough and well enough. Like, it's funny enough,
right.
I'm talking to you now from the NABJ conference, National Association of Black Journalists Conference in New Orleans. And it is this wonderful 3 or 4 days full of, like, upwardly mobile, nerdy blacks.
Right.
And we all perform blackness in a very distinct way. We dress like white hipsters.
Right.
But also want to make sure that we know all of the words to that new rap song by Cardi B. And we do this delicate song and dance of ensuring that we seem equal parts intellectual and down
and
to ride.
Right.
Uh-huh. It is performative. It is performative.
Totally. It's passing. I mean, we're always doing it. And it's very fun for me as a novelist to write about this particular world. And I'm always making fun of my own people and myself first. Like,
yeah.
I feel completely complicit in everything I'm ridiculing in this book. It's like, I wouldn't be able to write about it so clearly if I wasn't fully in that world and coming out of that struggle. I just remember also, you know, when Maria's in college, like, her stridency and she's sleeping with this white guy and she's kind of
but then the whole time saying she hates white guys, and it's like, girl, don't sleep with him then.
Exactly. No, she's kind of constantly dogging out this white guy at the same time that she's having sex with him. And I love characters that have full-on contradictions and, you know, that are problematic and that do the wrong thing. Like, those are the characters I want to be with as a novelist. Maybe not as a person, but as a novelist.
So you like, wouldn't I'm hang not out sure. with Maria?
I mean, I probably would for a minute, and then, you know, who knows? But she she was constantly, you know, like, her problems are all out there, and she's kind of mean to this guy, and he's kind mm-hmm. of clueless and bewildered, and she kind of leads him to a kind of suicide.
I know. Laugh. Well,
because it's not a real suicide, I should say, but she
yeah,
leads
he's
him
just
to
has a transformation.
Yes. He gets woke to being of color and to proclaiming his Chilean heritage, which is really minuscule. And he becomes a Latino queer artist and reinvents himself and gives himself a new name. And she's kind of watching in horror as this white guy who she constantly berated for being white completely changes in front of her eyes.
Yeah, which just underscores this central idea of the book, I think, that, like, race is performance.
Yes.
And how do you feel about living in that space where you're critiquing this part of people's identity that can seem so sacred and so personal? And is it hard to live
in
that space?
Right. I feel very committed as an artist to not allowing for sacred, you know, spaces and for being sort of going to those uncomfortable places and those places that you're not supposed to go. And, you know, I think of the artists who I'm inspired by. I mean, a lot of the Harlem Renaissance was what I studied in college. And, you know, there was this whole debate amongst the Black writers of that time about what we should expose to people about ourselves. And, you know, these debates about whether we were allowed, like, sort of respectability politics.
Like, don't tell family business, basically.
Exactly. And that's killer for you as an artist once you write from that place. And, you know, Langston Hughes wrote this famous essay about, I think it was like the Negro artist and the racial mountain, about how, you know, if white people are pleased with what we write, that's fine. If they aren't, that's fine. If colored people are pleased, that's okay, too. We're pleased to have written what we wanted to write. You know, the culture has gotten so, I think, in the last few years, I've sensed a kind of self-righteousness and a kind of people writing and speaking in a kind of fearful way around these subjects. And there's a place for people to debate what can and can't be said. But my role as an artist is not to kind of enter into that fearful space.
So then, okay, so we're in this society in this day and age now that lives by speed, brevity, groupthink, hashtag, or seems to, at least in social media. How do you maintain bravery and diligence and truth of purpose to these ideals you speak of really being subjective and respecting no sacred space? How do you maintain that in light of the environment we currently live in?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because I keep a small group of people that I surround myself with who I feel entirely able to say everything to, and you know, my husband and my close group of women friends. And, you know, I also have been thinking and talking about this subject for, this is my fifth book, and there comes a point in your life as an artist when you realize the worst thing is for you to feel kind of self-conscious when you sit down to write for those hours. And the worst thing is also not to be amusing yourself. And I was raised, you know, my kind of most fearless self was born out of my Black identity, actually. Mm. Like, the person in me who ruined dinner parties by outing myself as Black and responding to the racism I was hearing, you know, that was my kind of birth as a writer in a funny way, were those moments when I had to assert that self. And
I want to pause you just as a curious Black person. What do they say when we aren't in the room? Give me an example.
I mean, you can, it's a range, and it's funny, like every time it happens to me, it's less interesting. Like, it stops being interesting, you know, when people sort of have these conversations that are coded, but not really about a certain neighborhood and who lives there and whether it's a good neighborhood. And then the kind of coded language might fall away and they say, you know, you're going to be the only white person in that neighborhood. I don't think you should.
Wow.
And it's like, but I think it's tiring, but it's also kind of boring. Like there's nothing new to be learned about that.
Yeah.
Level
I'm also just like, wow, stop being so fragile. Like, if I stopped going places because I was the only black person there, I wouldn't leave my apartment.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? It's
like, exactly. But I think the thing that interests me is the kind of hysteria and discomfort and anxiety that my presence then brings to that space. And
once they know what you are.
Yeah, the feeling of either being betrayed that I didn't announce it before they said the thing.
How would you go about doing it? Hello,
right, we're
this
assigned.
Is Danzy. I'm black.
Yeah, or to like, the other funny thing I've noticed, I mean, these are the more nuanced things, is like, they kind of keep telling me that I don't look it, and as if I've never heard that before, and they keep wanting to tell
me that. It's like telling
that.
A fat person they're fat.
Right.
They know.
Yeah, like, wow, you're kidding. Oh my God, I better go look in a mirror. I really thought and just the sort of, those moments of anxiety are kind of interesting, but it's been kind of, you know, great vantage point to be in as a writer, because I think the thing that you can't lose as a writer is your outsider position. Like, that's golden for you, is those places where you felt outside, because that's the position you see most clearly from and read in the, you know, sort of
like
larger
that.
Sense of that word.
Yeah.
You can read from the outside. And, you know, I've thought about that idea of someone who's mixed, and we're constantly being, when you're racially ambiguous, and I think this is true for black people who are read as black, but like, you know, you're always kind of being read in a way as other people. Like, when you walk into a room and you're a black man and people get nervous, like, they're reading you as someone else, like almost like a ghost figure in their head, right?
Oh, yeah. And then you're very quick to, like, do something that disarms them.
Yes.
Either smile really big, make a joke, or, like, literally put your hands up so they can see your hands.
Oh, my God. Yeah, exactly. So you're always living with this ghost figure of the white imagination when you walk into a space. And I had a really moving experience. I went to Japan a year ago and was in Tokyo, and I gave a reading with a simultaneous translator to a group of Japanese people. And my first novel, all about passing, had just been published. And afterwards, all of these people stood up one by one, and turned out they were all secretly part or whole Korean.
Whoa.
And that their connection to my book and the subject of passing in the middle of Tokyo was a completely different cultural context, but they were crying and they were talking about how it had moved them. And
wow,
it sort of shattered all of my expectations. And talking to people afterwards, I had this revelation that, you know, we live in America where we're made to think that black literature is like this little shelf in the back of Barnes and Nobles, like separate from other literature.
Mm.
And when you go around the world, you realize that black literature has been this revolutionizing force on the rest of the world. And it's how people understand their own liberation is through black literature.
Hmm.
And like Audre Lorde and Toni Morrison, like this is the language of liberation around the world, everywhere you go.
All right, time for a quick break. We'll be right back with more of me talking to Danzy Senna. And in this next part, we'll talk all about the election of Barack Obama. BRB.
Support for It's Been a Minute and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. There's a great big world out there, and no other card lets you experience it like the Platinum Card, backed by the service and security of American Express. Support also comes from Sunbasket. Sunbasket sends organic and sustainable ingredients to your door, pre-measured and ready to go, so you can prepare delicious meals in around 30 minutes. Sunbasket takes the guesswork out of preparation, makes cleanup easier, and you get to skip the grocery store. With meals designed to fit every busy lifestyle, choose from paleo, lean and clean, gluten-free, vegetarian, and family options. Get $35 off your first order at sunbasket.com/menu.
Hey, y'all, if you like this episode of It's Been a Minute, then check out How I Built This. Every week, Guy Raz, host of the show, he talks to the folks behind some of the most inspiring companies and movements in the world. This show brings you stories of incredible persistence and grit and insight. It's really good. You can find How I Built This on the NPR One app or wherever you find your podcasts. Okay, I want to go back and talk about the students and the young people that you've encountered as a writing professor. Do you see a lot of them grappling with race in a different way than Maria does in the book? Because it seems like there's more of a fragility now to these conversations.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I mean, the character of Maria, we go back to her college days at Stanford, and, you know, we see her talking trash. She says she's standing in her hallway being professionally black and telling people.
I love that phrase, too, being professionally black. And since I read it, I've noticed times throughout my day when I start doing it. I'm like, Sam, you're being professionally black, right? Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we should all be getting paid for that. you know, like those hours you're clocking, explaining stuff. but she's just sort of, she's standing in the hallway explaining to a group of white students why this very blatantly racist poster is offensive. And I just remember like how strident we were and how much yelling we did in college. And and we were probably irritating in the same ways that students now are, you know, like, but I think we sort of were playing it out amongst each other and like not asking someone to police what each other were saying, but we were actually like yelling at each other. And whether that's better or not, I don't know. But there was something that shifted a little bit where we're trying to kind of keep things very clean.
And like keep some of those tough conversations from even having to be had.
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah. And I just resist anything where people start to think of identity as static and that you're always inhabiting one position. The idea that we don't all have oppressor and victim within us and, you know, and privilege and sort of unprivileged within us, like the idea that we're just frozen as this one representative and that doesn't shift in context is a hard idea for me because I know that we do shift.
And we can be more than one thing at once. I mean, part of what I love about your book, part of what I love about this new crop of like peak prestige Black TV, I call it. Like, you have these characters in shows like Atlanta and Insecure that aren't at all just really gifted Black guys or amazingly brave and bold and fierce Black women. They're awkward and insecure and strange, and there are a lot of different things at once, and they're expressing this level of vulnerability and simultaneously extreme openness in a way that's refreshing.
It is. It's really, like, I think TV is in some ways a little bit ahead of academia and the literary world, actually, in terms of those complex depictions.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is, but it's really interesting.
Yeah. You know, I could not help but reading the story of Maria in this book, a mixed race woman. Well, a Black woman, but who's light skinned.
I think of her as mixed and Black, you know. It's both. Yeah.
It's both. And I couldn't help reading about her without thinking about Barack Obama, perhaps the most famous mixed race man of our time. And then I did some digging, and there was an interview you gave when your memoir came out in 2009, Where'd You Sleep Last Night. When that came out, you were asked about Obama by Smith Magazine. Mm-hmm. And I want to read you the quote to talk about it. You said, "I was teaching college students at Occidental when he was elected, and I noticed that the young white men in my class were especially excited about him. It struck me that they identified with him for a multitude of reasons that had nothing to do with race. Because he was young, because he was internet savvy, because he was liberal but in a new school way, because he was a cultural hybrid and they felt themselves to be cultural hybrids. He spoke to them as a generation. So his election both speaks to the subtle nature of contemporary racism and also to the transcendence of other identities, which perhaps drew us all together in the end."
It sad seems to like think back to that, right?
Sad. Why is it sad? Explain.
Yeah, poignant. I mean, just that, I think that was written before we knew what was coming next. But you know, I did notice that I think that we have this sense of ownership as Black people, you know, but that he was somebody who, there were so many different identities going on there, you know, and my students were really identified with him. And he was not just ours. He was all of these young people's president, and a shift in their thinking about who could be president. You know, I always assume that everybody is passing. And when I walk into a room and I meet a stranger, you know, assume that you don't know everything about this person by looking. And because that assumption has been made with me so many times. I meet someone and I assume there are parts of them that I can't see.
Yeah.
So let them surprise you. Let their secret self emerge that's not visible. And that was kind of what I've learned a lot through teaching, actually. You know,
really?
I had a student who was kind of like a blonde frat guy, jock, really popular in a class on memoir. And I sort of assumed I knew everything about him based on looking. This was a long time ago at the beginning of my teaching career. And his first essay for me was about having cared for his severely disabled sister from the time he was little, and sort of like in high school, having this secret shameful self where he would, you know, have to care for this very, you know, nonverbal, non-mobile sister of his, and then her death. And you know, it was kind of like this shock to me. And I think that's sort of what bothers me so much about the kind of stridency of people, the Twitter revolutionary mindset, is the kind of idea that we are always on the right side and we always know everything about everyone else. And that is, I think, a really dangerous place to come from. And I, of course, have the Jonestown story in the memoir. And
that's
where that's like the most extreme version of ideology over humanity.
Can we segue to Jonestown for a bit?
Yeah. I'll never tire of Jonestown.
So I don't want to assume that all of our listeners know.
Yeah, whenever you've heard the phrase, don't drink the Kool-Aid, it's a reference to this 1978 cult that 1,000 people drank poisonous Kool-Aid together. 1,000 Americans died together under the command of Jim Jones, who was their leader. But most people only know that, if that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a white left-wing minister of the People's Temple Church in San Francisco, and believed in everything that we think we believe in. You know, most of us most people I know would have thought he was great at a certain moment. He was anti-racist. He created a multiracial church and was an activist.
A lot of Black followers.
A lot of Black followers, and a lot of the people who died there were Black, and created this multiracial utopia, socialist utopia, where he brought them all to the jungles of Guyana. And 4 years later, they were all dead. And it's a really fascinating, disturbing story that Maria is doing her research on throughout this novel. And the music of Jonestown, because they created an album and they had a lot of music there. And they sold their album, and I have their album.
Is it a good listen?
It's a really amazing listen, actually. And but you can't listen to it without the sadness of what, knowing that every voice on there is someone who died there, and all the children singing on it. You know, it's a heartbreaking album. But I was interested in that kind of groupthink and taken to the most extreme place, and how these ideologies coming before humanity are, you know, the thing we have to really fear in some way.
It's so true. You write, there's one line of the book. You say, how much Jim Jones loved Black people before he killed them. What a warrior against racism.
Yeah. And that was
that
sort
really
of,
stuck with me.
You know, the idea that we will have perfection or we will have nothing. And, you know, they were murdered in a way. Some of them willingly drank the Kool-Aid, but some of them didn't. And the mind control and the sort of fear mongering that he did. I think there's so many lessons to be learned from Jonestown. And so, you know, my hope with this book, because I touch on it lightly in a way, is that people will want to know more and go deeper into it, because it's one of those narratives that has fallen out of our, I think a younger generation doesn't really know what it is, and people have forgotten it. And it's, I think it speaks so much to our moment in about 20 different ways, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Now, what was the exact reason he gave for making them drink the Kool-Aid? Was he just like, we're going to go to heaven, or was it deeper than that?
He wanted to make a statement. This was his logic to them, was that they were going to make a statement, and this was going to be this profound statement of, he called it revolutionary suicide, that they were going to show that they will not accept a world in which racism exists, in which sexism, homophobia, they were going to, and so they were just going to all kill themselves, because they had been challenged from the outside, and there had been this congressman there trying to find out if people were being held against their will. And Jim Jones, being the kind of classic narcissistic, charismatic leader, the moment he's threatened or challenged, or that his secrets are about to be revealed, he has to get control. And his way of showing control was to kill all these people and then to kill himself. And so it was, you know, the details of it are just incredible that this happened, and that these were the bright, idealistic activists of that era. I mean, that was pretty obvious to me that I wanted to use Jonestown in this, even before I knew what the story was.
Are you hopeful about the state of race in America today? A lot of the themes that you pick up in your book, which is set in the 90s, are still very much with us. You know, the Brooklyn in the 90s in your book is dealing with gentrification then, in the same way that lots of people are dealing with it now. The questions of defining and occupying and performing race are still at the forefront now for people. Are you hopeful that things will get better going forward? Or is that even the wrong question to ask? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I always think about two things. One is the idea of permanent revolution. Like, I assume we'll never have to stop having these conversations. And the moment you think you don't is the problem. And I think Black people have been having one conversation about race, and white people have been having another. And it's like almost a non-conversation. And I say this like understanding that within those categories, there's a diversity of experiences and viewpoints, but in a generalizing way, like, there hasn't been a conversation really about whiteness and what is whiteness, and what do we, and that started when I was in college, where people would talk about, you know, white privilege and the invisible backpack and all this stuff. But Black people become the site of the conversation and the site of the gaze, and where we place our, you know, we look to Blackness as the way to discuss race. And that's kind of, I think, problematic, because it then puts all the weight of it on us. But I don't come at it as a, you know, politician or someone who's going to write editorials. I come at it as a novelist. And, you know, my job is to describe and tell this story, a very specific story. So I don't have any answers. I've you know, washed myself clean of that position. Like, I'm here to tell a story and to paint a picture that will hopefully leave you, you know, less certain of these positions than it was when you started.
I appreciate you challenging your readers to do that. And the book challenged me, and I just loved it so much. If you talk to Maria, tell her just to chill a little bit. Just
yeah,
chill,
she needs
just
to chill
a little bit.
No, but then there wouldn't be any story for me. I need her to keep going, right?
That's true. Hey, yeah. Well, this just made my day. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a lovely LA day.
Thanks so much for having me on your show and for all the great questions.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks so much. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Danzy Senna, she was so nice to talk to. Her new book is called New People. And if you happen to be in the D.C. area and want to come say hi, I'll be hosting a conversation with Danzy Senna at the East City Bookshop in Capitol Hill on Monday, September 18th. It's a free event. Come on by and say hi if you're in the neighborhood. It's also my first, like, book chat, so I'll be nervous. So a friendly, smiling face would be much appreciated. Again, East City Bookshop, Monday, September 18th. We'll be back in your ears on Friday with our regular wrap of the news, culture, and everything else. For that episode, send us a recording of your own voice describing the best thing that happened to you all week. Send that to samsanders@npr.org. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
In this country, some truths aren't self-evident. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as wide-ranging and real as the people who tell them, we celebrate the Black experience for all its soul and richness. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.